This is the Thirsty Developer, episode number 28 for July 25th, 2008. Agile and Scrum in the Enterprise. Welcome, everyone. Thirsty Developer, I'm Dave Bost.
And I'm Larry Clarkin. So, Dave, we spent all day today doing a class on application lifecycle management.
That's right.
Here at the Microsoft office in Downers Grove.
Yep.
We had a lot of our solutions partners and custom development partners in, and training them on you know what application lifecycle management means. So, Dave, what does ALM or application lifecycle management mean to you?
Well, Larry, so the idea behind this whole ALM process here is that what we went through is that we had a number of different teams, essentially four-person teams, that they went through kind of this ALM process. And what it was is they kind of interviewed us. We kind of were, in a sense, role-playing, I guess, where I was kind of playing the role of a dev lead. You were, what, project manager and DBA in one scenario. We had some other people doing kind of the QA lead. And then also, essentially, they were had a chance to interview us about kind of what, you know, we had a scenario that we're kind of wrapped around, talking to us about what our roles were, what the processes were, if there were any processes, if there are any sort of trouble spots or any problems that we're having, you know, with communication among different groups and stuff. And the idea is that they're kind of taking notes, talking to us about our project and our processes. And at the end result tomorrow, they're going to have kind of a report about this ALM, you know, process to see kind of where we're failing and what kind of recommendations they would have to kind of, you know, save us, if you will.
Yeah, about our fictional company where you're the dev lead and I'm the project manager, which is a scary notion in and of itself. But application lifecycle management is fundamentally about, you know, looking at your process, you know, and improving the way that you write code.
Yep.
And so ALM is a more formal process.
It's not just writing code, actually. It's everything.
Yeah. It's the entire project lifecycle for delivering software. You know, and it's one of the ways that you can look at it. You know, it involves tools, it involves process. One of the other ways is Agile, and we've talked about one facet of Agile development in the past on Thirsty Developer, and that was Scrum.
That's right.
Yeah, but in today's interview, I had a chance to talk with our friend Sean McCormick, up in Wisconsin, mm-hmm. about some of the things that they've done at his company to apply these Agile techniques like Scrum. And it was interesting because I asked him, I said, I want to hear about how you guys have applied Scrum in the enterprise. And before we actually started, rolling, the interview, actually recording it, he said, it's not just Scrum. You know, we've applied a lot of Agile principles here, and he's got a lot of good information to share. And what's so interesting is when you read the Agile books, when you read about Scrum, it's generally talking about small teams that are like shipping software. You don't get kind of the enterprise slant, when you're reading these. At least the books that I've read.
Right.
And Sean, works for a company that has SAP. They have like old school mainframe systems there.
This is true enterprise environment.
Yes, and they've got a lot of .NET development, and they've also got some Java development. So it's the true issues with enterprise development that you'd find. And I think that that he and his team have done an admirable job with bringing Agile principles into what you'd consider a more structured environment.
Great. So I think we should listen to that interview. Let's go.
I'm sitting down with my buddy, Sean McCormick. Sean, can you introduce yourself to the listeners?
Hello, everyone. My name is Sean McCormick. I'm a senior manager with a large alcoholic beverage company that's in the Midwest, about $5 billion company.
And Sean, in addition to working for the large beverage company, you also work kind of on the side. You've got a couple open source projects.
Yep.
You want to mention those pretty quick?
Yeah, I've done a few different open source projects. Have something called Adaptive Technologies, and under that I did Zanebug, which is an automated unit testing framework set on top of NUnit. Another one was CODIS, which is an automated code generation tool. And then I did one called Elementary, which is object relational mapping, and then something called the Adaptive Framework, which is really a enterprise framework similar to the Microsoft Enterprise Library.
Yeah, and folks, this is just to let you know, Sean, works during the day, and he does all these other things at night. In addition, we've seen you speak at the local .NET user groups
right.
a couple of times. You've taught us about Monorail and a bunch of other cool things.
Yeah.
So, I personally want to thank you for your contribution to the community in that. a few months ago on the Thirsty Developer, we did a kind of introduction to Scrum podcast with Ed Schultry.
Right.
And Ed's a buddy of ars. Yep. We hang out with Ed. Ed did a fantastic job. Ed's coming from the consulting side of the things, and he's also a trainer on the Agile and the Scrum technologies. You've actually done something that Ed and I personally haven't done, and that is implement Agile practices in a large corporate environment. Right. So we wanted to talk about some of those best practices
today. Okay, excellent.
You want to give everybody just kind of a thumbnail sketch of Scrum real quick, and maybe even like Sean's definition of Scrum?
Sure. So to me, Scrum, one of the beautiful things about it is it's really a framework to manage projects. It's not truly methodology, because it has very few deliverables or anything else that it calls out. It's really just a very flexible project management approach. So the beauty of it is we've actually applied Scrum even outside of the development world. We've used it for corporate strategy. We've used it in a lot of different business initiatives. And what's nice about it is you have that flexibility, and then underneath that, you can put in your own implementation. So you can define exactly, in the case of an enterprise, we have up to 10 different roles on a project. Scrum is only going to deal with a couple of those. So we can define how those roles should be engaged, what deliverables we need, and a lot of the other kind of enterprise assets that we have to deal with, but put Scrum on top to really manage that process.
Yeah, and it does work with, traditional methodologies.
Oh, yeah?
It's funny, you mentioned project management, and right. That's one of the things that you can do with Scrum. I actually, think of it more as a team organization. It's a way for and what's nice about it is it's a way for the team to self-organize.
Right.
It's not like you are in this role and you will only do these things, and these are the other roles you interact with.
Right.
You as a team get to decide who does what and when they do it. And really it provides this great structure. What's nice about it, in addition to the other Agile practices, it's very iterative, right?
Yeah, very much so. Yeah, and it's pretty flexible. I mean, if you take kind of pure Agile and you mesh with XP, I can take a Scrum sprint, and I should be able to do the entire lifecycle development in that one sprint, so everything from the design, build, test, and deployment. So you can take that, but you also can flex it where you do more of an iterative approach, where maybe I'll have one function that I'll go and develop over a couple of different sprints and have another one that I'm doing in parallel. And kind of cascade things. So it's very flexible depending on what your methodology is.
Yeah, and in your answer there, you mentioned XP,
right.
Which is extreme programming,
right.
Which is, it's not a competitor to Scrum. It's nope. It's really complementary. What are some of the XP practices that you've, personally applied?
Yeah, so XP, at least from my perspective, is more of a development-centric approach, whereas Scrum is more a process-centric approach. XP focuses on things like automated testing, continuous integration, pair programming, user stories. And so we've adopted a lot of those and combined them with Scrum to give us kind of a bigger picture that we go after.
So you apply in the sprint, we'll talk about the sprint right. In a second, some of those XP practices.
Yep.
And that's one of those kind of, you can almost do an a la carte kind of thing,
right.
With XP, because, for some projects, pair programming works great. Rocky Laka and I had this discussion, a few years ago that it's great when you're doing multi-threaded stuff and you need somebody looking over your shoulder at every line of code that you write. It's like, well, one night you've tied yourself to that thread. That's going to, you've got a race condition potentially there. You've got a deadlock. If you're writing, kind of CRUD interfaces, it's not necessarily, pair programming doesn't add a lot to that.
Right.
But that's one of those a la carte things.
Yeah. One of the things that we did is we actually developed an Agile maturity model. So we have 5 levels. And we said kind of across the board, if you look at design, development, teaming, all these different dimensions, how does the team actually progress through their maturity? And so pair programming, that's one of the things that we have really at the highest level of maturity. And very few teams actually get to that, especially if you look at SAP and kind of ERP, things that aren't your traditional object-oriented development, it's harder for them to do that. Whereas some other practices like automated testing, that's a lower level of maturity that we'd expect.
Yeah, so you expect that's kind of a low bar.
Right.
You've got to do, some automated repeatable testing.
Right.
That's cool. And that's one of the reasons I wanted to talk to you again was to see how, this the Schwaber, Scrum methodology. It's not just Ken.
Yeah.
But Ken is the father of Scrum.
Right.
How it, applies in these kind of instances, because like you said, with some tools, not at least, principles apply as cleanly as they do with others.
Right.
So let's walk through some of the specifics in Scrum, and
okay.
You can talk about some of your learnings there. The first is the backlog, and
right.
There are two backlogs. Let's talk about the product backlog, which for the listeners, if you didn't listen to Ed's introduction, is that's a list of everything that your business users could possibly ever want for, you know, in the application.
Right.
If I were to go look at one of your applications, you know, would I find the product backlog?
Oh yeah, definitely. So to me, the product backlog is absolutely critical because that really is the foundation of your project and what you're going to do. We have a product backlog and we actually use a prioritization method that comes from DSDM. DSDM is another agile methodology that comes primarily out of Europe, and they have something called Moscow prioritization. So you have must, should, could, and won't. And everything that we put in our product backlog, we prioritize according to that. So either we must do it, we should do it, we could do it, and we also call it things that we won't do, which means it may still be important in the future, but it's not within the current scope of the project. And the form of the product backlog, I've seen some teams use requirements. I don't think that really works well. Really what we try to focus on.
It's a little too low level of detail at that point, right?
Yeah, and it's too abstract. It's really hard to nail exactly what you're going after. So we focus primarily on use cases or user stories. Try to make it as functionally oriented as possible, have the use cases and user stories, and then just sort those.
Yeah, and that makes sense because the user, you know, or the product owner,
right,
is the person who owns that list. They're not going to feel an ownership with requirements, user stories, and use cases. They can grok. They can understand those.
Right. Yeah. It's very easy for them to come in and they kind of guide the session, but you have the whole team together developing the product backlog. It does a couple of things. One, everybody's able to hear the conversation and understand what it is the owner's after. Two, it's something that the owner can actually create themselves and then the team can talk about. And then three, it also forces the prioritization issue because most projects have a list and they say they need everything, but really there's only a few things that they actually have to have.
Do you feel a resistance with some of your owners to create a product backlog?
Yeah, I think the first reaction is always, well, we need everything, so why are you making me prioritize?
Yeah.
so that's always tough to get past, but once we just kind of explain that we're not saying we're not going to do everything, we just need to figure out what provides the most business value to you and get that in your hands as quickly as possible. They start to get it, and then once we actually get into it, a lot of times you'll see everything as a must at first, and then after doing, you know, a couple of hour session with them, we get to true prioritization. And once they get that, then they actually flip and become very flexible in the product backlog and prioritization.
That sense of ownership,
yeah,
you know, is a key indication that you know, part of Scrum is working.
Oh yeah, right. It's huge. Yeah. And I think that's probably one of the biggest benefits we've gotten out of it is, in an enterprise, you tend to have an antagonistic relationship between the IS and the business. So the business is trying to move fast, and you've got IS that's more centralized and controlling and viewed as having a lot of process. A lot of times what will happen in a project, if you're doing more of a waterfall approach, is the business will give a bunch of requirements. The IS group will disappear for a year and then come back afterwards with something, and it's the IS group is expected to make decisions along the way as to what's important for the business, which just doesn't make sense. When you have a product owner engaged, they're actually making all the decisions. They actually own the product. And so they really get what they want. And now you have a team concept versus a handoff or pointing finger approach.
Yeah. The resistance that I personally, you know, saw with the product backlog when we tried to adopt Scrum,
yeah,
before coming to Microsoft, and this was on a Microsoft project, was, you know, the business owner saying, well, I don't want to be tied down. I want flexibility. And the converse of that is, well, yeah, you're tied down, you know, at a point.
Right.
Because you can always add things to the product backlog.
Yep.
Can't necessarily add things to the sprint backlog.
Right.
But, you know, we'll talk about that one in a second. So the flip side of this is that, you know, if you're held to this is the list of what I want, the product team is accountable for delivering things on that list.
Right.
And that's where the light bulb goes on. It's, oh, okay. So this is, you know, this is the list that, you know, they can't, you know, create other things on the list. This is the things that I want delivered.
Right. One of the things that we do is whenever we kick off an agile team, we do a 2 to 3 day training workshop session where we have the product owner, the entire team, and we teach them about product backlogs and all those, all the different artifacts and roles. And one exercise we go through is, let's say you're the Outlook product team. So you actually have to develop Outlook software. It's, you know, 1994, and we come up with a list of features and then ask people what's most important. So you have spell check-in, you have calendar, you have send and receive email, and that helps them understand very quickly that, okay, you know, send and receive email is going to be much more important to me than spell check-in. Doesn't mean I won't get to it, but they realize that we need to get that business value in the hands of the users as quickly as possible.
And the training is very important.
Oh, yeah.
You know, there's some great books on Scrum.
Yeah.
You know, and we've talked about this in the past that you can't just hand somebody a book on Scrum. Because one of the issues with it is that when you read the book, it seems really simple.
Right.
You have to, you know, get in and experience it. So I think training will do that for you. You guys almost do a mock Scrum project, right?
Right.
And the other thing is that, you know, having the experienced Scrum Master, you know, as your mentor, at least when you start off, I think is important. Do you guys have a formal mentor program for that?
Like, yeah, we do. So actually, when we started the initiative, we brought in an outside consultant, individual named Lowell Lindstrom, who used to work with Object Mentor, is kind of rooted in the whole Agile approach. He really helped us develop the capability, and then we started developing Agile Mentors internally. Actually had a formal Agile Mentor program, so we did a bunch of projects, found other people that really got it, put them through a 10-week Agile Mentor program, and then from that, the people that really excelled, we started pulling out into more of an Agile coach type mode, and that's really what we're focusing on now. And so they were able to conduct the training sessions and really help guide the teams.
Cool. I think that's the best practice. You know, that's an obvious one. Just don't try to, you know, do this from scratch unless you absolutely have to.
Right. And I think that's one of the biggest mistakes teams make is they read the book and they feel like they get it and they jump into it. And you've really got to have an Agile coach. I've seen so many teams even here, you know, try to get ahead of themselves. And you've got to have someone that's been through it before to really guide you. Doesn't mean you won't figure it out, but it's going to be a lot rockier than if you have someone there to kind of help you along the way.
Absolutely. So let's talk about the second component, which is, you know, still the backlog, you know, but the sprint backlog.
Right.
And that is, you know, why don't you go ahead and explain the sprint backlog.
Okay. So we do the product backlog, and then the next thing we do is something called a release plan. And the release plan really says, these are the major milestones that we're going to have. This is how many sprints we're going to have. Here's the cadence for each sprint. And we'll come up with high-level goals for each sprint. Once we come to that sprint, we take those high-level goals, and then we validate them, and we do something called sprint planning. That's where we look at how many resources we have, how much time do we have available, and we simply just go to the product backlog and say, for example, let's say I have a team, and we have 1,000 hours worth of manpower available. Then I'm going to go down that product backlog, and I'm going to take the top priorities and break them into tasks and keep doing that until I've reached 1,000 hours. So you just go down the product backlog, pull the highest priority item off, break it down into tasks. Those tasks then become your sprint backlog. And that's what the team focuses on for that sprint. And that should be the only thing they're focusing on.
Yeah, that's the locked in stone.
Right.
You can't change that. And we'll talk about the sprint in a second.
Sure.
Because one of the key questions there is how long is the sprint?
Yeah.
But one of the questions I have is where do you guys keep, you know, the backlog? I mean, it's interesting that there's a lot of tools available, some that are specific for Scrum. Personally, you know, we always fell back to the Excel spreadsheet.
Right.
it's corporate America's favorite database, right?
Yeah. We've done a lot of different things, and we've tried not to be dogmatic about it and say you must use this approach. It's really dependent on the makeup of the team. If we have a team that's completely on-site, so everyone's able to co-locate in one room, then most of them prefer to use stickies on a board. And they just have cards that they move around. If it's a distributed team, they have a couple options. We have Excel, so we use SharePoint, and they just do versions of Excel, track it in there. We've used a tool called Jira, which comes from the Java world. It's primarily for defect management, but we found that to be pretty good for product backlog management, also issue management, those type things. We're looking at other tools, so we try not to really dictate what the tool is because we have onshore, offshore, co-located. The focus is get the value out of the sprint backlog, make sure you have it somewhere where it's accessible, and make sure that's what you focus on. The medium isn't that important to us.
Yeah, we had this discussion years ago that it'd be great to have, you know, a fantastic automated SharePoint site to track this. But if that's what you deliver at the end of your first sprint, the business owner is going to be pretty disappointed.
Yeah.
If you say, oh, yeah, by the way, we used an Excel spreadsheet to track it, they're going to be okay with that as long as you deliver something, you know.
Right.
Don't focus too much on the tool itself.
Exactly. And we've done SharePoint lists also. One thing I found with Agile is there's always a tendency for people to try to go to the high-tech solution. And a lot of times the easiest thing is just to get people in a room, write something down on some stickies, and move them around. So don't get too focused on the tool. Focus instead on the intent of the exercise that you're doing.
So one of the questions I had about the specific, you know, the sprint backlog,
right,
is you talked about, you know, grabbing the items off the product backlog. There's going to be some natural dependency between some high-level priority tasks, some medium-level priority tasks, and some low-level tasks.
Right.
You know, how do you factor that into your planning? Because it might be, well, this is a low-priority task. You know, they don't need it for 6 months, or it's much lower than other things. But because I can do it at the same time as a high-priority task that's got a high correlation with that, you know, it would normally take me 16 hours to deliver that. I can deliver it in 4. Is that something that you guys would pull on to the sprint backlog because of the correlation with a high priority task?
It really depends on the context we have done that. So let's say I have a sprint where I've got 1,000 man hours and I've filled 900 and the next highest priority items are just going to be too much work. Then we would look at a lower priority item that we could kind of stick in there. If there's a dependency, then definitely. A good example is security. A lot of times you'll have functionality that's really important. Security is important, but it's kind of further down the list. You know, people defer that for implementation. But if it's something that I have across most of my high priority items, then I'd pull that up front and do that piece.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's interesting that you mentioned security. Is that an app actual feature on the product backlog? Is performance on there?
Yeah, it's a philosophical debate, so it really depends on how you approach
it. That's why I brought it up.
The way we tend to do it is because we focus on normally we start off with the user story, and that's just a statement from the user saying what functionality they need. Then once we start doing more detailed analysis, we take that and blow it into an actual use case, and that has more of a narrative. I can build test scripts off of it. As part of that use case, I'll have specific requirements around performance, business rules, those type things. If I have a requirement that ends up crossing multiple use cases, then I would actually pull that out and have it as a standalone item on the product backlog. If it's something that I can embed within a single use case, I'll just leave it in there. So we try to have everything be functionally focused within the product backlog, but for more enterprise requirements that are non-technical, we'll call those out and make sure they're prioritized accordingly.
Okay, now we've got our sprint backlog.
Right.
Now we're actually going to go into the sprint.
Right.
Big question, how long is a sprint?
It varies. If you look at Ken's literature, you know, his focus is on 4 weeks, and it definitely shouldn't exceed 4 weeks. We've tried a couple different things. We've done 2-week sprints, 3-week sprints, 4-week sprints, even done 1-week sprints. I don't think there's a correct answer. It really depends on the project. We tend to focus on 3-week sprints. If you do 2 weeks, it's very aggressive, and you have to realize there's no time for recovery. So if something goes wrong, if my source code system goes down, if I have network issues, if there's a major bug we never expected, you're not going to have time to recover and you'll fail your sprint. If you give people 4 weeks, there's almost too much padding in there, and it's easy for things to get pushed out or analysis paralysis to take place. We found that 3 weeks is just aggressive enough to keep the pressure on but still allow teams to recover. So that's kind of our default length, but it really varies.
So 3 weeks, and I've actually, again, back to the philosophical debate, because the original original framework said 30 days, a month, 4 weeks, whatever you want to do it, was that so many people were set on that. And I think it's okay to change that number.
Sure.
I think that it's not necessarily changing it, it's adapting to how your team works best.
Right.
I personally think that 2 weeks is really aggressive because you said the recovery time, also because there is some natural ramp up and ramp down time. You don't get to amortize that, you know, over the cost of the project if you're doing, you know, 2 week sprints.
Right.
I actually, you know, had an interesting discussion with a Scrum Master. I won't name him, but he said, you know, that what he found is that most of the developers did all the work in the last week, so why give them 3 weeks to goof off? Why not just give them 1 week to goof off? And it's funny because there are generally a lot of heroics the last week of a sprint.
Yeah.
But that's okay, right? But you know, the saying that we're only going to give people 2 weeks is, I think, a little aggressive.
Yeah.
I think a lot of it depends on the project, though, and it sounds like you guys have been very flexible with that.
Yep. If you look at, for example, we've had projects that were 3-month projects, so very aggressive. In that case, we had to do 2 week sprints because we had to have enough control to make sure we were on track. If we did, you know, only 3 checkpoints along the way, we would have gotten off track.
That's not enough iterations.
Right.
Yeah.
If you look at custom development, it's a lot easier to have shorter sprints. If you look at large-scale ERP implementations, SAP, those type things, it's very difficult to take everything they have to do and compress it into a 2 or 3 week window. So a lot of times when we're doing SAP-type development or projects, we'll go 4 weeks there because they have so much they have to do around configuration, documentation, testing. It's much harder for them to get through their full life cycle just because of the scale of the platform.
We already mentioned... moving on to the next sprint concept.
Sure.
You already mentioned the kind of planning meeting or the kickoff meeting, you know, whatever you want to call it, where you, you know, identify, you know, the backlog, you get the team organized and you start going. I think that the most fulfilling part of, you know, a Scrum sprint is actually the last day or the last 2 hours of that when you do the demonstration.
Right.
And let's talk about what the demonstration is.
Okay. So when you do your sprint planning, you come up with your sprint backlog, the main thing that comes out of that are your sprint goals. So it's just a short list that very clearly calls out to everyone what exactly we're going to deliver in that sprint. At the end of the sprint, we have something called a sprint review, and that's where you bring in not only the team, but all the stakeholders, anybody else that's interested, steering committee, whoever needs to be involved to actually see what was delivered. And so it's a pretty good exercise for the team to be able to show off what they did, but also for everyone that has a stake in the product to make sure that it's progressing as expected. So for a sprint review, you'll have the team come in, they'll show the goals, they'll give a status update on whether they hit the goal or they missed it, and then for each goal, they'll go show the actual, they'll evidence the goal. So for example, if they built a report, then they would actually run that report, talk through it. If they came up with some type of functionality that's in production, they would actually pull up the production app, walk through it. So it's very powerful for everyone. One of the things that we found is really cool is if the product owner, someone from the business, actually steps forward and runs a session, because now it's not a tech person talking about the value. It's actually a person from the business.
Yeah, and one of the things is that that they talk about in the Scrum methodology.
Yeah.
In the Scrum documentation, is they actually talk about, this is all potentially shippable software.
Right.
This isn't, it looks good, now let's go spend 2 weeks putting the spit and polish on it and let's get it ready for production. This is, theoretically, if they were to say, put that in, go, that you could do it, nearly immediately.
Right. That's conceptually how it should be. And I've run smaller software shops where we definitely were able to do that. One of the problems we've had in the enterprise is when you're dealing with offshore teams, matrix organization, large scale platforms, a lot of times it's very difficult, especially in the early stages, to go through that full life cycle, because I'll have to do, design. I've got Sarbanes-Oxley compliance. I have capital funding I have to get approved for, all these different things. So we, depending on the platform that we're dealing with and the maturity of the team, normally we push to get through the full life cycle, but you'll find a lot of teams that may only do a functional technical design for a sprint. Then the following sprint, they'll do the build and the QA. And then the last sprint, they're doing all the defects and the UAT system tests and those type things. So conceptually, that's how it should work. But in practice, in an enterprise environment, it's harder to do.
And this is exactly the kind of stuff that we wanted to talk about, applying Scrum. Because I'm going to bring up a word. I don't know if you've heard this one or used this one. It's Scrum Fall. Or watered down Scrum.
Yeah, I've heard that.
Yeah, and Scrum Fall specifically, this is the term that we used is our team is doing Scrum, everybody else in the corporation is doing Waterfall.
Right.
So, and our frustration with it was we could have something potentially shipped, and it could take longer than a sprint to actually get it deployed because of, you mentioned all the compliance things like Sarbanes-Oxley, Gramm-Leachman bilevel, HIPAA, there's this alphabet soup of compliance that we have to go through. And so that's, we always, that was kind of one of our frustrations is we're doing Scrum, but it seems like nobody else does. If we, if at the end of the sprint, if our business owner said, yes, go with that, we're ready, but it's like, okay, well, it'll be 5 weeks before you see it in your application.
Right.
Because we've got to go, it's going to take us 2 weeks to get the release manager, in a room to have the initial meeting. And then, they're not going to want to push it out for another couple of weeks.
Right. And then you have communication plans. And, in our case, when we roll out new functionality, a lot of times we have to do global training for that functionality. So we push as hard as we can to get that done in a single sprint, have it production ready, even put out there. But depending on the platform and the environment, sometimes we have to do more of an iterative type Scrum.
Does everybody in your, I don't know if you guys are called IT or IS, does everybody know what Scrum is, or is everybody aware of it? Is it pervasive?
Yep, very much so. So we started.
I think that's one of the hurdles to getting over, Scrum Fall.
Oh, yeah. We actually started the initiative almost 4 years ago. And at the time, it was kind of a small rogue group of people that were doing it and were successful. But the perspective was, well, that's great. It worked for you in a pure software environment, but there's no way it'll work for all these other projects. And over time, a lot of the work was around just building the business case and doing the change management, not really even focused on software development, but more kind of the corporate politics and, resource planning, governance, all the other things that you have to address. And we slowly started to build a list of successful projects and finally got to the point where on site we were doing it for almost every critical or large scale project that we had. And now we're in the process of doing it in a global distributed model. So we have all projects pretty much following that methodology now, but it definitely took a while to get there.
Well, and it's hard to argue with success,
yeah,
right? I think that's one of the key things is that you had a lot of successful projects.
Right.
And success tends to gravitate people who might be against a concept
right.
towards that concept. You know, they want to kind of, you know, own it, make it their own.
Yeah. For us, it was really cool because it was a lot of it was grassroots. So we'd get a project team, and once they started using it, they really became huge advocates for it. And I was not only was the project successful, but the people loved it. And so then I could use them as evangelists and have them go out with me into the organization to kind of preach to their peers about the value. And I think that was a major thing that helped build momentum.
Okay, we've talked about backlogs. Just right. to recap for everybody, backlogs. Sure. We mentioned the Scrum Master. We mentioned the product owner. We've got the team involved. They got a startup meeting. They've got the demonstration at the end. Daily stand-up.
Right.
And this is like, to me, the linchpin, you know, of whether you're really doing Scrum or not.
Yeah.
Is, you know, how your daily stand-ups go. Tell us about that.
Yeah. So daily stand-ups are a 15-minute session that the entire team is required to be at. And then stakeholders, anybody else that's interested can come observe. The important thing is it's got to be quick and crisp, and the whole focus is on synchronizing the team. So basically talking about what they did yesterday, what they're doing today, and what are the barriers. So it's just a very quick status and communication session. One of the things that I found very valuable is even with teams that in the past weren't doing Scrum, it's a great management technique if I have a team that's in trouble. First thing I'll do is switch them to a daily stand-up, and you very quickly are able to identify, you know, what are the issues, who are the different players, what are the barriers, and it really helps you just kind of keep your pulse on things and keep things going forward.
So the $64,000 question, do you guys actually stand up in your daily stand-up?
Definitely. Yep.
Okay.
Yep. And the philosophy behind that is if people sit down, they're going to get a lot more comfortable and, you know, sit back and talk and analyze. If you make people stand, they're much more focused on getting it done and getting out of there. So I make sure every team's standing. Something else I focus on is trying to get them out of their environment so they don't have their cell phones and their laptops and all these other things to distract them. Really, they should be standing in a circle, focusing on each other, and just bang through it and then be done.
Yeah, and it should be just one of those, you know, quick checkpoints and you're right. done kind of thing. Do you penalize people for not showing up or showing up late?
Yep. We've done it a couple different ways. My preference is I do $1 per minute up to $5, and then I just put that in a project kitty, and we'll use that for bagels. If you have a team that's really bad, you can donate to charity. There's different things you can do with it.
And we used to have a heck of a happy hour on the last day,
yep.
funded entirely by the people that were late. It's interesting, the buck a minute. You ever heard of Branch Rickey? He was the general manager of the Brooklyn Dodgers, and then before that, the St. Louis Cardinals.
Okay,
he actually started this, you know, with the whole concept that, you know, there are no new ideas. He actually used to fine players if they showed up 2 minutes late. He charged them, fined them for 2 hours.
Wow!
And they go, well, what? I was only 2 minutes late. And he said, there are 60 people here waiting to get this, you know, meeting going. That is 60 people, 2 minutes. That's 2 hours. You're paying for it. So it's kind of cool that you do it per minute.
Yeah.
You know,
that's a good idea. I'd probably get in trouble if I tried for the 2 hour approach, but,
with the 10 person team, no, that would be 20 minutes. So.
Yeah.
Yeah. That could get expensive really quickly, but I got to tell you this, I wouldn't be late more than 2 days.
Exactly. Yeah.
at that point I'd learned my lesson.
Right.
So the daily stand up, you know, really important. To me, that's the real criteria of are you even attempting Scrum?
Yeah.
I actually ran into a developer, and I think Ed Shaltry and I talked about this, that he goes, oh man, I just got out of our 2 hour daily stand up.
Oh.
And I'm like, whoa, you know, you want to like actually have the penalty flag to throw.
Right.
It's like, okay, who's your Scrum Master? Let's go talk to them. They didn't read the book, obviously. There's a lot of misapplication of Scrum because a lot of project managers go, wow, I get to talk to developers every day.
Exactly.
We're going to work through every one of these issues in excruciating detail.
Yeah.
And you can quickly see how a stand-up could turn into 2 hours if you actually try to solve every problem there.
Yeah. It's critical that whoever's running that meeting edges on being rude almost. I mean, they've got to keep people on track, keep them focused, cut them off if they start going off the board, and really just keep the pace going so that you get them out of there in 15 minutes.
And this is, I think, is where we talk about self-organization,
right?
You know, with these principles, I think this is one of the things where it can come up.
if you're hearing that somebody's struggling, you're going to come over and help the guy.
Mm-hmm.
If you feel that he needs a kick in the pants, you're going to give him the kick in the pants, because it's like, hey, this is the second day in a row where you said you got nothing accomplished the day before because you were having machine issues or this kind of issue, or, you know, source control issues. You know, you get in shape, or let me help you get in shape.
Right. Yeah. I mean, one nice thing is it applies the peer pressure model. So not only are they standing in front of you, but they're standing in front of all their peers, and it becomes painfully obvious if someone is struggling or they're focusing on the wrong things or they're having performance issues. You know, after one day, you start looking bad. After 2 days, it starts becoming an issue. One of the techniques that I use is if somebody misses an item that they were going to get done the following day, I actually put a number up for how long it's been up there, and I track the number of days that it's been up there, and I put it in a red marker. And if I get past 3 days, we're going to start having some serious talks. So it's good. It's a good way of not even having to address the performance issue by just putting a visible marker that puts the peer pressure on them to deliver.
Yeah, it's interesting. A lot of people, I mean, I personally am like this. I'll let myself down before I'll let my team down.
Right.
You know, in other words, I'll work late that night, you know, to make up for stuff, you know, but I don't want to let, you know, other people that are dependent on me down. Yeah. And I think that's where, you know, Scrum and related methodologies. I said that word again.
Yeah, that's okay.
I think that's where it really, you know, the real power of it. You mentioned in the Daily Stand-Up the observers,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, the old, you know, pig and the chicken joke or whatever. The observers are the product owners, the stakeholders, you know, anybody who's not directly on the team that can observe this.
Yeah.
Do you guys find that people actually show up to that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And I mean, we've had it, you know, up to the senior VP, even C-level people drop in just to see how things are going. So it's been very successful because if I'm a business owner or a project owner, I really want to see how things are going, how the team's behaving. And that's just a great pulse point to come in and look at.
And in your role within the organization, do you make it a point to drop in on, you know, the stand-ups?
Yep, yep. Obviously, can't make it to all of them, but I try to, you know, randomly rotate through. And especially if I have a team that's struggling a little, it's one of the most powerful methods I have to understand what the issues are. Because after literally 2 to 3 days of attending the daily stand-ups, I can very quickly see, you know, are they removing barriers the way that they're supposed to? Is the team gelling? Are they communicating? Are they raising the issues? It just gives you a very good insight into the team dynamics.
And the Scrum Master we mentioned before,
mm-hmm.
You know, just to formalize it, that's the person who is the mentor of the team to make sure that they're following the Scrum methodology. Their primary job is removing those barriers that you talked about.
Yeah.
They're not necessarily the project manager.
Nope.
Because there could be another project manager who's organizing the overall effort.
Right.
I always use the example of, is, you know, if you're going to do something like, you know, roll out a kiosk nationwide, there's a lot of things that go into that. The software development's only one piece of it. The Scrum, there may be a Scrum Master for the entire project, but, you know, the guy who's working on the software piece of it is the Scrum Master. He may be working with the project manager to make sure, you know, that all those things are in sync. Generally, though, do you let that person be part of the team, have deliverables on the team, or do you have them separate from the team?
We've done it a variety of different ways. So going back to your point about the project manager versus Scrum Master, almost every project that we have has a project manager, and the project manager is responsible for the overall success of the project, and they're dealing with the financials, they're dealing with outside communications, project status, those type of things. The Scrum Master is responsible for the success of the sprint. So their whole focus is on, you know, tactical execution, removing barriers, getting the team to those sprint goals.
Cool.
Bring back the question.
Oh, was it?
I got sidetracked.
Oh, do you find that Scrum Master also will like write code on the project, for instance?
Yeah. So we've done a variety of ways. One is if we have a very large team, we'll have a dedicated Scrum Master, and really their whole focus is execution of the sprint. If it's not a larger team or a larger effort, you can have anybody take on the Scrum Master role. So we've had project managers also serve as the Scrum Master. We've had development team leads do it. And in that case, they're more sharing their time. So they may be doing 20% Scrum Master stuff and then 80% coding or whatever other responsibility they have.
But ultimately, that Scrum Master responsibility's got to overshadow anything that they're doing, right? They got to make sure the sprint's successful first, even at the cost of their personal, you know, investment in the project.
Definitely. Right? And one problem I've seen with teams is if you get somebody that's a really good architect or a good team lead, what they love is the coding. And so if a problem arises, they'll kind of take their hands off the steering wheel to go deal with that, and it'll kill the whole team. They instead have to delegate to somebody else to take care of the technical issues if they have Scrum Master duties they have to execute, because that's what keeps the team focused.
Yeah, it's interesting because with when you read the Scrum principles, when you read the book, mm-hmm. you know, it is really easy to think, well, the Scrum Master could be a very light part-time job if everything goes correctly. And it could.
Yeah, it could.
The reality is that oftentimes that turns into, some days it's a full-time job,
right?
You know, where you're doing nothing but dealing with the issues that were raised in that 15-minute meeting. The nice thing about that is that you are dealing with the issues, not the product team. They're off being, productive.
Exactly. Yeah, it allows them to really focus on the goals that they're supposed to deliver against, and then someone else can go worry about taking out the barriers.
So one final question to wrap up.
Sure.
And this is the area of, you know, when I read the Schwaber material, when I read, you know, about Scrum and all, the scalability of Scrum, because it works absolutely great at that team level. I've always been skeptical of the concept of the Scrum of Scrums. And part of that's because I've never done that. And that is where the Scrum, because it scales up and down nicely between a 2-person team could do, you know, a Scrum,
right.
A 15-person team, when you start getting above that, you need to split into teams. And then, the principles say that you should, you know, still have the small, you know, about 10-person teams, but then after they do their daily stand-up, then they should get together in a Scrum of Scrums.
Right. Yep. And we've done that. We've actually had teams that were 100 to 150 people where that's the only way we could.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. That was one of the bigger projects.
Were you guys launching a space shuttle?
you would think with the amount of people we had engaged. So that's one place where we had to use Scrum of Scrums. And there's a couple different ways you can do it. One is I can have teams grouped by functionality.
Or feature teams, as sometimes they're called.
Yeah, feature teams. So that would be a mixture of business analysts, systems analysts, developers, QA, and they're focused on that feature. And then what you would do is whoever's leading that feature team would run the daily stand-up for that team, and then all those team leads would come to another daily stand-up and cross-communicate about features for the entire project and status. That's one way you can do it. Another way is platform-based. So if I have a .NET team, and I've got an SAP team, and I've got a business intelligence team, I would have the team leads run the daily stand-ups and then come together. Normally what you'll see is I'll have, for example, a business analyst that's managing 4 BAs, and I'll have a lead developer that's managing 10 developers. I'll have a QA lead that's got 5 testers. Each of them would run their daily stand-ups, and then they'll come to a Scrum of Scrums where now I've got a cross-functional view of how's QA development, business analysis, data analysis, all that doing, and that'll be run by the PM. And then if you're doing something at a program level, then the PMs across all those different projects could come together at the program level and do a daily stand-up across all the projects on their status. So it actually really does scale well. I actually think even in a large enterprise, you could go from the bottom of a project all the way up to the C-level in less than 2 hours and have a status update for the entire company on how things are progressing, and you'd only lose 30 minutes total because you'd have 15 minutes in your daily stand-up and then 15 minutes in your Scrum of Scrums.
Yeah, and the key thing there is the people doing the work, you know, not the Scrum Masters, the people doing the work themselves, they're productive after 15 minutes.
Right.
You know, the worst, if you had 3 levels, you know, you're talking 45 minutes. And that's the person who's, you know, doing the Scrum, you know, with the C-level person.
There. Yeah. It's really just the leadership that would have to do the back-to-back. And it really would only be 30 minutes because they would run their daily stand-up and then go participate in their Scrum of Scrums. Then whoever's leading that one would turn around and go to their Scrum of Scrums, and you can rapidly scale up a whole organization that way.
Well, that's cool. I guess I'm a little less skeptical hearing that it actually does work. Key thing there, I think, is that you've got 150 people singing the same tune, speaking the same language.
Yep.
Everybody knows what Scrum is.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the cool thing is, you were talking about before, you know, this is not necessarily purely software development. We've used it, you know, in that 100 to 150 person team. We had corporate strategy, we had marketing engaged, we had communications, we had senior VPs from totally outside of IS involved in daily stand-ups, co-located with the teams, participating in sprint reviews. So it's something that really transcends just an IS group. It's something that an entire company can participate in. And we've even had people apply it completely outside of IS to their own management processes.
Cool. And then come back and tell you, hey, that was successful.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Yeah. Yeah, it's cool stuff because really, you know, I can take any effort and all I have to do is prioritize the work, set some short-term goals, review how we did against that, and just keep iterating through that.
So any last best practices to share? Anything we didn't cover that you want to to the listeners?
Yeah, I'd say probably the biggest thing for me is the Agile principles. If you look at Scrum and XP and DSDM, all those are different ways to go about it. But you should always go back to the Agile principles because that's really the foundation of anything. And the way I always kind of evaluate a team and figure out how we can improve things is I just sit down and go through the Agile principles. And as long as they're living according to those principles, they're going to be fine. And you can take Scrum, you can take XP, whatever else to help guide you towards those. But any methodology or framework that you have, the activities and the output should always tie back to the Agile principles. And that should be your foundation.
Great. Thanks for your time, Sean.
Yep. Thanks
for being
much.
On the Thirsty Developer.
Yeah. Appreciate it.
Interesting interview, Blair. So I have to ask you, you know, after you talking to Sean, what do you see are the or what did you learn as far as differences in enterprise around Agile methodologies?
I think it's just an understanding of the scope of it, right? Because when you're talking about, and we talked about, you know, during the interview, the whole, you know, how do you scale Scrum? And, you know, that's important, you know, to scale it beyond a small team of like 10 to 12 people, right? But scaling it out to the entire organization there, I think is what I really learned there, that it is possible, but it's a kind of a multi-year journey, right? And he talked, I think that the real victory, you know, in his learnings that he shared with us is the fact that Scrum is, you know, Scrum and Agile principles aren't just for IT, because they actually have seen that their business partners are applying it, you know, in their projects, you know, that are non-technical.
Right. So, great information there. I mean, you know, we kind of hear about these methodologies. They kind of, you know, taken off in the past, say, I don't know, 5 or 6 years, and it's really started, you know, proliferate itself on the environment. Now it's starting to hit the enterprise, which is, it's a good thing to see.
Yep. And both the ALM principles that we learned about today, you know, here at Microsoft, and the Agile principles, I think that there's a place for both of those. And I think Sean showed how you can have the discipline to have compliance with SOX and other things and still have the Agile process, you know, on your actual development team and your business team.
Yeah, great. Great interview. So I think with that, we should move on to a blog, you should know. And I'll kick it off this week, you know. So essentially what you know, my blog, you should know, is actually a blog from the CodeBetter.com site. So CodeBetter.com is kind of a collection of these developers who are kind of following this alt.net, I don't want to say movement, but just kind of more practices.
Yeah.
Essentially, the idea about building better software with different tools and thought processes through, you know, in the .NET world. And I actually ran across this blog, and actually I attended an alt.net meeting in Chicago recently, and this actually came up during one of the discussions about this particular article. It's actually an ebook written by Carl Seguin, and I hope I'm pronouncing his name right. If I'm not, I apologize. But Carl Seguin wrote this. Essentially, he took a collection of his blog posts and turned it into an ebook. And what it's called is called The Foundations of Programming. And it's actually a great read as far as talking about, you know, the foundations of programming in the .NET world. And he talks a lot about sort of the all .NET thinking and their different practices and such, and some of the tools that are involved. And actually, I saw this also posted. Scott Hanselman on his Twitter account posted kind of a recommendation for this read. So check out Carl Seguin's blog on CodeBetter.com. We'll have a link to it, obviously. And do a search for Foundations of Programming ebook, or just do a search for an ebook on CodeBetter.com, and you'll probably find it. But it's a great read, and I highly recommend it.
So his exact blog address is CodeBetter.com/...
It's CodeBetter.com/blogs/Carl Seguin.
Yeah, and just so we're clear to the listeners that you're not necessarily recommending the entire CodeBetter.com blog network, because that's a lot. That's a lot of blogs you should know.
Yeah,
yeah, and most of the guys on there are really good. You should
still keep an eye on that blog. I mean, there's a lot of great bloggers on that site, but there is also a lot of content, so I don't want to overwhelm you, but there's quite a few people that you should definitely check out on the site, the CodeBetter.com website.
Well, I'm being entirely selfish because there's probably like half a dozen blog you should knows we can get out of that in the next few weeks.
Yeah, so we'll
save it
for later. Yeah.
So my blog you should know, Dave, was inspired by you. A couple of weeks ago on your birthday, you actually got a digital camera.
Yes.
And you asked me, you said, what are some resources that I can learn, you know, how to be a better photographer, particularly, you know, as somebody who's new to digital photography?
Yeah, my wife surprised me. I always said that, you know, I kind of wanted a nicer camera to kind of take pictures of the kids as they're growing up. And, you know, we got the typical point shoot stuff, but I kind of wanted something that give me a little bit more power. So a little more of a digital SLR camera. So she got me Canon Digital Rebel XSI. And so as soon as I got it, I knew exactly to call you to say, okay, what are some recommendations to kind of get me going here?
And what's funny is that, you know, I'm really an old school guy. I've been shooting for about 20 years. I actually started on film, if people remember what film is.
What is – I have no idea what you're talking about. What is
it's back when you used to take a photo and then you're like, ooh, I got to hope that came out. And then, like, you know, a couple of days later you find out if it did or not. So I started pulling together some resources for you, and I know you found a great, you know, site that, you know, has got some, like, you know, learning on there. We watch videos, and you actually send your photos to them, and they critique them and all that.
Yeah.
What's that?
Betterphoto.com. It's, yeah. They don't have videos. It's essentially what it is. They have online courses where you have an instructor who's a professional photographer, and they kind of have weekly lessons, and you submit photos, and they critique them and such, yeah.
But one of the resources I told you about was This Week in Photography, or TWIP. Their blog is actually twipphoto.com. They actually have a companion podcast. And it's interesting because it's really – they've done a good job with going back and forth between the podcast and the blog. I think the blog pretty much has a post every day, and the podcast is, you know, weekly or biweekly depending on if they have a video podcast that goes with it. So it's a great site for somebody who's, you know, getting into digital photography because they cover a lot of the basics, but also it's a good site for advanced, you know, concepts. Like they've been talking a lot about, high dynamic range photos and, you know, should you be shooting in RAW or JPEG? So that's, if you're interested in photography at all, twipphoto.com is a good one to check out. And after you listen to The Thirsty Developer, you can go download twipphoto.com.
That's right.
Podcast.
Yeah, so I checked out TwipPhoto, and when you say they're advanced, I'd say they're pretty advanced because...
Oh, well, they got some high-end topics on there, too.
Yeah,
because
there's definitely... When I was checking it out, I was like, it was way beyond my comprehension talking about these, you know, thousands of dollars of, you know, in lenses and all this and that. I was like, I'm not ready to go there just yet, but, you know... Teach me, like, the basics, you know, composition, exposure, those types of things, and we'll kind of go from there.
Yeah. And as long as we're talking about a blog, you should know, I got one other note for our listeners. Last week we had a bit of an audio issue with the show, so I actually had to, in the editing process, I actually had to cut the blog You Should Know because we had a strange echo. So I want to apologize for the show, you know, sounding kind of premature in its end last week, but A Blog You Should Know is still a regular feature on the show.
Yeah, just know that we're on a shoestring budget here, so we try to make it work as best as possible. And actually, you know, Larry, you know, we're together today because we have this little event going on in Downers Grove, and, you know, because you came down from Wisconsin... What do you always do when you come from Wisconsin?
Well, I bring two things with me. I'm bringing a lot of things with me, but there are two things that I have to stop and get, and that is some New Glarus Spotted Cow, the official adult beverage of Thirsty Developer, and I got some Wisconsin cheese curds for you.
So I appreciate that. So first of all, we got to get our salespeople, you know, talking to New Glarus for sponsorship there, I think. So we better get on that.
Yeah, we have salespeople.
But so I definitely still appreciate you bringing the spotted cow. So here's you, Larry. Let's try that again. That was the weakest. There's to you, man. So thanks for the spotted cow. I appreciate it.
No problem.
Before we head out for the week, I have to know, Larry. I got to know this. So last week we were talking. You were going for this super achievement or something.
Oh, you want the Lego Indiana Jones update. Yes.
Lego Indiana Jones update. So just to kind of bring everybody back around, last time we were recording, you were playing Lego Indiana Jones while we were recording, but you weren't really sitting there playing it. You had Indy on some sort of trampoline bouncing up and down, collecting these little Lego studs or something so you could reach a certain amount.
Yeah, there's a little Lego treasure that spits out every time Indy bounces on a trampoline, and there was no trampolines in the movies. But to give everybody an update, yes, I did eventually get to 2 million studs or points or whatever. It's 2 million treasures, what they call it in Indiana Jones, and I was able to get that achievement. It took, you know, a few hours, you know, even after we were done recording our episode, I kept it going and checked on it periodically just by turning on the TV, and I eventually did get the achievement and then went on to get 100% on the game.
There you go.
So it's pretty well complete at this point.
So what's your next game? What are you playing next?
Well, now, so my 7-year-old son, Hunter, he has to get to 100% on the game. And so, believe it or not, Dave, yesterday Indy was bouncing on that same trampoline, but on my son's, gamer tag, not on mine. So
nice. But speaking of kind of Xbox Live, I want to kind of invite Thirsty Developer listeners. We'll see how this works. You know, but essentially in 2 weeks, on August 9th, we're having our, once again, kind of our are we have these get together Halo 3 Frag Fest where we kind of get the different team members together and people who work in Microsoft or people that we know and just kind of get together on a Saturday night because, you know, we're married, we have kids, so we have no life outside of that. So, so Saturday night we get together, play a little Halo 3 Frag Fest, and I'm definitely going to invite, you know, Thirsty Developer listeners to come join us.
It's about 9 o'clock Central Time.
Yep, 9 o'clock Central Time. Halo 3 Frag Fest on Xbox Live, August 9th. You can essentially find us, you know, just friend us on Xbox Live and see where we're at, and we'll send you a game invite. You can reach me on BogeyD, BogeyD, and then Larry, your gamer tag is?
Bottom of the ninth, or bottom ninth.
Bottom ninth.
Yeah, and our gamer tags are in the show notes, you know, of the Thirsty Developer Show.
That's right. So I think with that, hopefully everybody can join us, and I think we'll close out this week's show. Why don't you kick off, Larry? Why don't you close it out this week, time?
Okay, I'll close it out this week. You know, as always, we invite you to comment on each and every show at thirstydeveloper.com for general show comments and for show ideas. We've actually gotten a lot of show ideas from our listeners. Send an email to thirstydeveloper@live.com. You can reach myself, Larry Clarkin, at larryclarkin.com. Dave, you can reach him at?
Well, of course, it's daveboss.com. Yeah. I you know what? I need to come up with a cooler name, man.
Yeah, we've got to work on cool names.
Yeah, so if you got any recommendations for a blog name, you know.
And we're also on Twitter, Facebook, and LinkedIn, and publish with our names.
Twitter.com/DaveBost.
Twitter.com/LarryClarkin. Facebook, search for our names, Larry Clarkin. LinkedIn, search for our names,
we're
Larry Clarkin, Dave Boss.
That's all we're doing.
Yeah.
We have no friends.
I'm at 193 Facebook friends, so whoa. Seven more, and I'm nice. And I'm there. So.
Actually, speaking of Facebook, so through Facebook, I actually got an invite to my 20-year high school reunion.
You going?
Oh, I don't know. That's going to be
you got to bring the podcast gear.
I'm not bringing the podcast
gear. Oh, my God, because you got to record, like, you know, they're going to have Styx Paradise Theater playing in the background.
All right, I'm not that old, man.
Oh, yeah, that was my 20th high school reunion, which was last year, by the way.
No, I definitely, and you know, I go back and see some old friends. It'll definitely be interesting, but it's kind of scary at the same time. I literally have not seen these people in 20 years. So maybe I'll give you a little update on that.
And with that, we'll really close out the show.
Absolutely.
Everybody have a good week.
All right, take care. I'm wiped.
Yeah? What you been doing?
Well, first of all, you just handed my ass to me in Halo 3.